How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on Figure Four Daily. It is Tuesday, September 24, 2013, here at figure4online.com/WrestlingObserver.com. We are joined today by George the Animal Steele, here to talk about his career, his new book, so much more. And George, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Your book, which is available Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, all sorts of various outlets, Animal. The George the Animal Steele story appears to have been published in April of this year. And I was reading an interview that you did, and it seemed like it was done a long time ago. There was no date on it, but I would guess probably maybe even 10 years ago. And at the time, you mentioned that you were working on a book. So my first question, how long has this book been in the making, and how did you go about finally getting the book deal?
Probably been in the making 20-some years, maybe 76 years, who knows?
It's a long time. So I presume that this was shortly after you retired that you actually started working on it. Was it something that you got to work on, as you said, maybe 76 years ago or so, and you finally got the book deal, added some stuff to it, and here we go?
No, that wasn't it at all. It just... We attempted two or three times to write the book, but it wasn't ready yet. God wasn't finished with me yet, so it wasn't the right time. The timing was perfect. This is kind of my swan song. My career is over, and my bucket list is short, so it's just a perfect timing for me.
What else is on that bucket list, just out of curiosity?
Pardon?
Anything else on that bucket list that you'd like to make public?
Madison High School football team in Madison Heights, Michigan, that I coached at for 25 years, to win a state championship, and the Detroit Lions to be in the Super Bowl.
Really? Now, you did have the field named after you, Madison Heights. Is that correct?
That's right. That was very humbling.
The Jim Myers Stadium. There's a picture of it right here on your website.
Right.
When did this happen?
Last October.
Last October. And I guess, what were your thoughts? How did they approach you about this? And at the time, I mean, what were your first thoughts when they told you this? Were you presuming this had to be some sort of joke, or were you like, my God, it's about time?
No, neither one. I told them, I said, it's very flattering, but I don't think anyone should be honored in that way until after they die.
Mm.
We talked about it along those lines, and they decided to go ahead and do it. I was behind it 100% once they decided, but that was my feelings. I don't think anyone should be put on a high pedestal like that. But there's still, as long as you're living, there's still opportunities for mistakes.
Now, you are in the Michigan High School Coaches Hall of Fame, and I think a lot of people are aware that you were coaching at the same time that you were wrestling. And apparently it took a while for your students to really figure it out. I guess some people had suspected it. They would bring in magazines and you would deny that it was you. What was it like being a high school coach and at the same time doing this wrestling and people slowly starting to figure it out?
I never really lied to anybody. I never ever said that wasn't me. I always said, do you really think I look that ugly?
I see.
As they pointed to the magazine, because then, you know, your integrity is pretty important. I said, do you really think I'm that ugly? And that's not really my name, is it? And we'd all kind of laugh. And those were kids that had, you know, it happened not often, but occasionally when some kid would move from the Northeast, where I was all over the place, to Madison Heights, where our local TV was not covering the WWF. It was covering the local television where I wore a mask.
As the student.
Territory days.
And you at the time were working as the student.
That's right.
Who came up with the idea for the student?
Bert Ruby was a local promoter, and I was making $4,300 a year in 1961, coaching two sports and teaching, and I had two children, a third was on the way. Obviously, I needed a part-time job, and because of my learning disabilities, which I cover in the book, I was looking for something physical, and Bert Ruby answered the call. We decided on the student because I was learning the business. I was wearing the mask because I didn't want all of my students at school and the administrators to know that I was wrestling.
How much wrestling?
It was always a part-time job to me until January 1986, when I quit teaching and went full-time with the wrestling. Most of my career Wrestling was part-time. My main job was teaching and coaching, but I made my living wrestling, and I left an awful lot of money on the table every year when I'd leave the WWF and go back to Madison Heights to become Jim Myers, the football coach and wrestling coach.
Now, 1986, you went full-time, and right. And about 2 years later, you retired due to health problems.
And 1989,
so about 3 years. And you talk a lot about the Crohn's disease in your book, and I was unaware of this, but apparently at the time that you retired, you were told that the disease was such that you may not have long to live. Is that correct?
It estimated 6 months to live, but then I was very, very sick for 10 years, deathly ill. But again, in the book is all about overcoming obstacles, and the disease, Crohn's, led me to my belief in the Lord Jesus Christ. So I look at it as a very positive thing. And I was a hardhead, so he had to beat me over the head a lot to get my attention.
Sure. Now I don't know a lot about Crohn's disease. I know what it is. A couple of people in my wife's family, I think, have Crohn's disease. But what, I guess you're in remission, I guess, is the best way to term it right now.
Oh, no, that's not right at all.
No.
I'm totally cured.
Totally cured.
But
totally
the doctors tell you there's no cure. I mean, you know as much about it as the doctors. Here's what they told me when they found out I had Crohn's. They said, we don't know the cause of it. There's no cure. This is what we want to do. Now, that doesn't make any sense. They don't know what it is. They don't know where it came from, and they have something they want to do to me? Come on.
Sure.
So I fought that mentality for a long time. Very, very sick. And in the long run, like I said, it turned my life around. And there's no... there's only one place in the world that I know of that you can find out about the Crohn's disease and the cure of it. And it's a blood test that they do in California. I think it's Prasanna Blood Banks. And I've been declared totally free and cured from Crohn's. And I owe that to the Lord Jesus Christ, in my opinion.
So who directed you to the, I guess, the place in California where you ended up being cured? How did you first find out about that?
Boy, I can't even tell you that. I was all over the place. I was looking for all kinds of answers.
Sure.
And in the process, I sent this blood test, and at this time I was starting to feel pretty good. And that's when I got, you know, so many things were going on at that time, and there was no plan. I mean, I was dying. They'd give me 6 months to live, and I was hanging on. So to keep notes, and I didn't do that. I'm dyslexic, so that wasn't something I was going to do. Again, it was in God's hands.
So when did you first get the word that you may have 6 months left? Was this right around the time that you retired? How sick were you when you were doing the, probably what a lot of people remember you for, the peak period of WWF in the late 80s?
Well, I was on the road. I was deathly ill. I didn't know it. I was doing some things... because of my age, I was 50 years old, and all the other guys were 26, 27, 28 years old. Mm-hmm. I was an old dinosaur running with the young bulls. So, and I was just, you know, I always had great energy and had, you know, never got tired. I started feeling awfully tired, and I started going to a holistic doctor in Michigan, mm-hmm. and they gave me what we would call jet fuel, the very best vitamins and minerals that money could buy. And I was getting it through an IV process. Mm-hmm. And that would give me my energy back, and I would go out on the road and go for about 6 or 7 days and wind down again. So what I was doing in reality, looking back, I was masking the disease and the fact that I was bleeding to death internally. When I finally told Vince McMahon that I wanted to take some time off, take a couple of weeks off, the first day I went to the doctor, the second day they put me in the hospital, and I was in the hospital on IVs. 30 days trying to rest my colon and the rest of my digestive system. I was, you know, my blood count at that time was down to, probably around 7, 6.5, 7. At 4.5, you die. You're supposed to be at 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. And I was at a point where if I stood up, I'd start shaking and fall down. I was losing blood so fast it was unreal and masking it. So, you know, again, it's just who would know? I mean, the fact that the whole book is about overcome the fact that I was very dyslexic and couldn't hardly read or write coming out of high school, being made fun of in junior high, in elementary school. And because they didn't know what to do with me back then, they didn't know what dyslexic was, they would send me to the gym. Well, you go to the gym every day, you should become a pretty good athlete, which I did. I got into Michigan State University on a scholarship for football. I was signed, sealed, and delivered to Notre Dame, but I got married coming out of high school, and you weren't allowed to go to Notre Dame at that time if you were married. So God was looking out for me way back then. And then I get through Michigan State somehow. No breaks. They didn't give me any breaks. But I end up teaching and coaching. But I'm not making enough money. So I start looking for something to support my family, and the wrestling come in. It was a part-time thing to support my teaching. And I maintained that for a long time. Then I was invited to Pittsburgh because a guy by the name you might have heard of, Bruno Sammartino, came to Detroit. He wrestled one of the guys here. Who was it? Bulldog Brower. Mm-hmm. And they spotted me with the mask on, and I was invited to go to Pittsburgh. I got to Pittsburgh. They did not want a mask man. They wanted me. I didn't want to use my real name because I was a teacher and a coach. So Johnny DeFazio, a guy from Pittsburgh, said, well, this is a steel city. Let's call him Jim Steele. I said, I like the steel. I don't like George. Jim. Somebody else said George. So that half of my body is only about 46 years old. And the rest is history. I mean, it's just unbelievable how, on a part-time basis, I could climb to the very, very top of the WWWF and be one of the very top challengers to Bruno Sammartino. Later on, Pedro Morales, back to Bruno Sammartino and Bobby Backlund, and even the Hulk over that period of time on a part-time basis. Every year I'd go back and teach and coach. And, you know, that's just the way it was. And you look back at it, and this is what I tell people now when I talk to people at my book signings. Everybody should write a book. Now I'm looking at my life through a rear-view mirror, and I can see where God was touching me before I ever knew him. I mean, my wife and I were baptized and went that direction in 2002, but all these crazy paths that I went down, you can't say that was just by accident. That's crazy. That's why the book is being so well-read, and so many people are getting a lot out of it. It was a tough choice to write a book, because to write it right, and talk about dyslexia and a learning disability, and a little boy, 7 or 8 years old, standing up in front of the class reading with the Brown Group, which is, you know, they had blue birds, yellow birds, and green birds, and brown birds. Brown birds meant you read like bird crap, I guess. Anyhow,
that's nice.
Go through all that and end up where I ended up is miraculous. And my feeling is if that story can help one person, whether it be with their health, with the wrestling, with the coaching, and learning disabilities, or whatever, then it's worthwhile.
Now, you mentioned Bruno Sammartino, and 4 days ago, on September 20th, 1975, so 38 years ago, you and Bruno Sammartino had a stretcher match at the Philadelphia Spectrum, and Andre the Giant was a special referee. Do you have any memories of that match?
I just remember it was a good match. I don't remember much about it, no.
Yeah.
I wrestled Bruno so many times in so many different situations all over the Northeast. I mean, Boston, we had a stretcher match in Boston. We had one in Philadelphia. We had a cage match, cage matches all over the place. We had a match in the gardens, Madison Square Gardens, where they wouldn't allow us to have a cage, so it was a money cage. And every time either wrestler would go on the apron, it cost him $500. And if they went on the floor, it cost him $1,000. So the money was the cage. I've had every kind of match you could possibly have with Bruno. And you know, they were all pretty successful.
Now, main event with the WWWF champion at the time. I know you did a lot of Madison Square Garden work. You talk about coaching and being part-time until 1986. Was it a situation where you were doing very well in wrestling, but not well enough to quit your teaching job? Or did you just have such a love?
I was at the very top end of the wrestling business, the very top end. But remember, I started wrestling in 1962, 63, on a part-time basis to support my family. It remained a part-time job, even though I was making six times what I was making teaching in 2.5 months. It was not ever about the money. It was not ever about not quite good enough. How much better could I be than the top challenger in the history of the WWF? I mean, where are you going to go from there?
So to you, it was a love of teaching and coaching.
Absolutely.
Now, one thing I wanted to ask you about, which kind of steps away from wrestling here, but somebody on Twitter asked about it, so now I need to ask about it. You were a part of Ed Wood, and I saw this movie, God, probably right when it came out. I loved that movie, and you played the part of Tor Johnson, and I thought you did an exceptional job. You looked remarkably like Tor Johnson, which I guess... Had that happened before you got the role in the movie? Were there people that mistook you for George or Tor Johnson?
I never realized what was going on, but I would have people come up and tell me that they saw me in a monster movie, and I didn't know what they were talking about, and no clue.
Yeah.
And then when Tim Burton called me, he started telling me about this Tor Johnson. I looked like this movie star, and I thought, I look like a movie star. And then I researched the part and found out that Tor Johnson was the first guy to do monster movies without makeup. That was a backhanded slap, but I knew what I looked like.
What a compliment. It's a good thing that that he wasn't in your on your team when you asked them, do you really think I look that ugly? He would have said yes.
Well, they probably wanted to say that too, but the kids were polite.
Sure, sure. Now, did Tim Burton ever tell you how he, did he watch wrestling? Did someone bring up your name? How did he think to call you?
As he was putting this movie together, he wanted everything in the movie to be as close to the work that Ed Wood had done. Now remember, Ed Wood had made 7 of the worst 10 movies ever made. So he was trying to duplicate 7 of the worst 10 movies that was ever made. And Tim Burton, you know, is an oddball a bit out there. And he kept looking. He didn't know if he was looking for an actor or a wrestler. But as he was looking for a lookalike, my name kept coming up. And then he finally invited me to Hollywood. I was out there anyhow with the WWF as an agent, running the shows for the WWF. He invited me in, and he told me I was the perfect look, but I was too short. So at that time, I thought, well, this isn't going to happen. And about 6 months later, he called me and says, we fixed it up so you can have some elevator shoes, and you can be 6'4" instead of 6'1". And now I'm only 5'9", so I wouldn't have a chance at all. I'm really shrinking. But that's how the part came about. And it was, the first time I was on set, somebody says, well, aren't you nervous? And I said, no, not really. And Bill Murray laughed and said, this guy's been acting his whole life.
That's right.
It all fit in, I guess.
You know, it's funny because, like, some wrestlers go into acting and it's an easy transition, and some go in and it's a difficult transition because, you know, if you're not acting, if your role in a movie is not a wrestler, then you've kind of got to tone everything down. And a lot of wrestlers are used to turning everything up. But you were actually playing a wrestler.
Right.
So was it, I mean, he pretty much answered the question, but it was easy to slip into the role, I presume.
Well, he was, first of all, Tor Johnson was not a very good wrestler. And so it was a very low-keyed wrestling role that I was playing. He was not an over-the-top, you know, guy that could do great interviews like Roddy Piper or somebody else who's flying over the top rope. Tor Johnson was just more of a monster actor than he was a wrestler. He just happened to be wrestling when they found him. Not a real good wrestler at all.
Did you get to put any input into the film? I mean, was it very, okay, here's a script, do it exactly like this. Were you allowed to do a little bit of improv, make suggestions?
Well, then Tim asked me a lot of different things when it comes to the wrestling end of it. There's one point where we're going into a movie theater and I run my head into the ticket booth.
Yes.
I suggested that, and I did it about 3 times. So my head was getting a little sore, so we put a little sponge up there so that when I did it, it didn't hurt as much. Yeah, I made a lot of suggestions on how my character would fit in. But Tim was very open to all that. Because if you can make it look like it was in the black and white days of Ed Wood and fit it in, it was perfect. And I think everybody on the set had a little bit of input.
What was it like working with Johnny Depp? I seem to recall that he was having some problems in his life prior to that film. And getting a chance to play Ed Wood, where he was just like a constantly happy, optimistic character, really helped him in his real life. I mean, did you get to interact with him much?
Oh, an awful lot. Yes, I did. And he's just a great young man, or was a young man back then. One of the incidents that happened, he owned the Viper Room in Hollywood, which is a bar, show bar. And this young guy had a drug overdose.
River Phoenix.
We were making the movie in this bar of Johnny's, and he come the next day, and He wasn't there when it happened, and he came right to me because he knew that I had been an agent with the WWF and had to work with a lot of different difficult situations. He said, what should I do? I said, well, let's just close the sit down, allow no media here, and you don't talk to anybody till you talk to a lawyer. And the bottom line was the Phoenix River is who I'm talking about. Or the River Phoenix. I mean, yeah. I can't get it backwards, I guess. Anyhow, you never heard much about that death happening and being tied up with Johnny at all. And it wasn't really. It was just a matter that he owned the bar. But no, Johnny was a good guy. Very helpful. All those people were very helpful. Martin Landau was unbelievable. He won an Oscar for playing the role of...
Bela Lugosi.
But he was just very helpful to me. Everybody was helpful to me in that movie. They all looked out for me. It was great. And it was fun. It was like a family, honestly. When we did the premiere, usually a movie premiere is more about the actors interplaying with the media. We kind of kicked the media to the side. And it was our premiere in the Lincoln Center was more like a family wedding. We all just bonded together. I think it came through in the movie that way, too. The movie was well-received in Hollywood and in New York. Probably died in Peoria.
I was kind of disappointed that the movie didn't... sometimes you watch a movie and it's like... It never really became like a giant hit. And it kind of makes you sad because you kind of feel like if more people would have just seen it, it would have the word of mouth would have spread and it would have been like a big deal.
Well, what's unusual about the movie, and I think it was designed to be that way through Tim, is it's still being used and will probably always be used in film schools because it shows how it was done way back when and how we do it now. It's a backup. It was just it was more of a teaching aid for young people than it was anything else, I think.
Now, when you first decided I need something here to supplement my income, and wrestling sort of kind of came along, had you watched wrestling to any great degree prior to this? I mean, what was your knowledge of wrestling before you decided, okay, I'm going to give this a shot?
I was not a wrestling fan at all. I was a football guy with my knees blown from college. I never even considered looking at. I mean, if it was on, I just kind of maybe picked it and went on past it. It was never anything that caught my attention. I was looking for a job as a bouncer in a bar, and I took a friend of mine, David Pierce, who I found out that if you're drinking beer and got a friend, you don't get hired as a bouncer in a bar. So I didn't get hired. But David was a huge wrestling fan. And David is the one that taught me into calling Bert Ruby about 1:30 in the morning. I want to be a wrestler. And he invited me over the next day and took a look at me and said, beautiful. So I figured, uh-oh, what's this all about? Because I know what I look like. And he explained the business to me a little bit and then sent me over to Windsor, Ontario, through a tunnel from Detroit to Windsor, Ontario, to a Catholic church where they had a gym set up in the basement and the wrestlers were going to break me in. I told my wife I was going to be going over to Windsor to learn how to be a wrestler, and she laughed. She said, you'll never make enough money to pay the tolls in wrestling.
So, wow.
No, wrestling was not just, again, God was in control before I was.
Now, you were a great athlete, obviously, the football, and you'd done a bunch of sports in high school, baseball, basketball.
I was one of the very few people, but remember, I had a learning disability, so they kept sending me to the gym. I'm one of the very few people that run four sports, varsity baseball, basketball, football, and track for 4 years. That's 16 varsity letters. Not many people did that. Again, they kept sending me to the gym. Whatever was in season, I was getting good at.
Sure. So,
again, you look back at it, you know, walking through it made no sense. Looking back at it and putting God into the equation, it makes a lot of sense.
So you go to wrestling school, and as noted, you were a great athlete. And what were your thoughts walking in there? I mean, did you kind of think, all right, I've never wrestled, but man, you know, 16 letters, I should be able to do this. Was there concern?
I didn't have a clue.
No clue.
At about the age of 11 or 12, I'd been a failure in everything. And I was bigger than most of the kids, and my parents had told me, don't you ever fight. If you're bigger than somebody, you're going to hurt them. And my dad had lost his eye in a fight years before that.
Really?
So kids would pick on me because remember now I'm a dummy. I'm not learning in school. I'm a dummy that's, you know, and I'm bigger than most kids, so I'm a big dummy. And kids would pick on me, and I'd run home crying. One day, my mother had had enough of that. She said, okay, and we lived right across the street from a grade school playground. This was in the summertime. She said, okay, Jimmy, you're going to fight. So she took me back and said, over there. I come home crying. They said, she said, Jimmy's here to fight, and they all come running. Yeah, yeah, you know, big crybaby. She had taken the handcuffs off. So the first guy there was a bully by the name of Mickey Fulton. He lasted less than 30 seconds, and Billy Hinton was next. And there was about 12, 15 kids there. All of a sudden, they started disappearing. And my first success in life at doing anything was fighting. So from that time on, they sent me to the gym. And then when I was out of school, I was always looking for a fight because that was my success. I was not a scholar, for sure. And so going to a gym with four or five guys that are wrestlers, and they're going to beat me up to teach me to respect the business. That was right down my alley. So if they hit me, I gave them a receipt. I knew how to fight real well. And in that short period of time, they said, okay, we're going to show you what we do here. So they started showing me how the wrestling business was to work, which made me angry because they thought they were challenging my integrity as an athlete. Now, remember, all I had was athletics and the ability to fight. Mm-hmm. So now they're going to tell me it's a show. So that kind of irritated me, too. But years later, once I learned the art of working a match, and it is an art to it, then I learned to really respect the wrestling business. But at first, I had no respect for it at all. I just needed the money.
Now, let me ask you this as a coach and a teacher and also somebody who was bullied. In 2013, in a lot of places, I mean, you don't fight at school. Even if you get attacked and you defend yourself, if there's a fight, you're both suspended. I mean, done. They're really clamping down. As somebody who was bullied, I guess for a long time, and then finally you went to that playground, you fought back, and all of a sudden, you know, I presume that was kind of the end of the bullying. What are your thoughts on how things are today?
Boy, you just hit a button. You might not want to listen to what I'm going to tell you, but you open the garage door, so here it comes.
I want to hear it.
I think society needs to get the hell out of the way. This politically correct nonsense is ruining our society. I think that every boy needs to be in a fight. He needs to either get the snot knocked out of him or knock the snot out of somebody else. It's part of growing up. What we're growing now is a bunch of wimps. They don't even know if they're boys or girls anymore. I think society needs to get the heck out of the way and let our kids be kids and let them become men and women. Didn't expect that, did you?
I don't know. I mean, it's based on your history, I kind of did expect that, to be honest.
Well, honestly, I mean, everything is falling apart. Why is our country in the shape that it's in right now? It's not Democrats and Republicans, although both of them suck, because they're all into politics for their own personal gains and not to take care of the country and the people. But our society is falling apart. How did people that are in leadership roles right now get elected? By a bunch of wimps, that's how. Now they're trying to take hitting out of football. Give me a break. All they have to do if they want to bring football back down to a little different level is quit making the helmets so that they're concrete and take the face masks off.
Let me ask you about that, because you've been in football forever. Yep. So obviously there's a lot of issues with concussions nowadays, and they've got all these fancy helmets. And there's a theory that back in the day when you just had the pigskin wrap around your head, there were less concussions because you knew, okay, I don't have much of a padding here on my head, so I probably shouldn't run headfirst into another guy. So by making these padded helmets, you're encouraging guys to go headfirst into each other, and you're actually making things worse.
The equipment has made it worse. My senior year in high school was the first year that face masks were required or even allowed unless you had a broken nose or something. And back then, everybody had a broken nose because we didn't have face masks. And I told the coach my senior year, I said, I'm not playing football with a face mask on. This is for a bunch of wimps. And after I had played football one game with a face mask on, I don't think I could have played it without it. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because I didn't get a broken nose. I didn't get hit. You know, I wasn't knocking teeth out and all that. To me, take the face mask off and put the old helmets back on like they played back in the 40s, and your injuries will go down.
Interesting. We've got a question here from Rip Rogers, who, of course, wrestled forever, really. He wants to know a little bit more. He just says, talk a little bit about your schedule, what it was like during the school year when you worked for the Sheik in the summer, or I guess school year for the Sheik and then the summer for the WWWF.
Well, at first, when I first started wrestling just for Bert Ruby before the Sheik, I had a really tough schedule. I would get up at 7 o'clock in the morning, go in and teach. After school, 3:30, 4 o'clock, I would start coaching. Be there till 5:30, 6 o'clock, get in the car and drive somewhere, maybe like Grand Rapids or Muskegon or Toledo, Ohio. It's after the show, get stop with the boys and have a few drinks, get home about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, get up the next day at 7 and repeat the whole thing over and over again. It was really a tough life. I needed the money or I wouldn't have done it. It was about the money. I was never enthralled at being a big TV star or a super wrestling star or anything like that. To me, it was about the money. And that's, you know, people say, well, why would you leave the WWF and go back and teach in high school? Well, because it wasn't about the money. It was about, you know, it was about the money so that I could make enough money that I could afford to teach and coach. I was never starstruck by it. And I feel sorry for a lot of the guys that have been. A lot of them have died very young. They get caught up in a sad lifestyle. And, you know, that was never a choice of mine because I never felt like I was a rock star wrestling. I was just a jabroni trying to make a few bucks so I could afford to teach and coach. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Do you feel that going back and teaching and coaching when you weren't wrestling kind of helped keep you grounded and that maybe without that it could have been a different story?
Oh, absolutely. It kept me stable in a lot of different ways. When I was out on the road, when I would leave my family and go to New York and Boston and Philadelphia and that place and leave my family, that was not Jim Myers. That was George Steele. And I lived a lifestyle that I'm ashamed of. I did it all, my friend. I did it all. I was never really big into the drugs because of the teaching and coaching, but I'm ashamed of my lifestyle, the drinking, the ladies on the road, the whole bit. I did all that. And then when I got real sick and I died twice on the table from the Crohn's disease, not really from the Crohn's disease, from the drugs they had me on, prescription drugs. And then I started looking for a faith in Jesus. I really felt like I was unworthy because of the lifestyle I lived on the road. And it took me a long time to understand that the blood and the man on the cross did that for my sins. And I sure had a bucket load of them, and it was a tough thing for me to just understand, because making that change in my life, I thought it was going to be really tough, and it was just so unbelievably easy. That's what blows my mind. Where I'm at now is 1,000 miles away from the road that I traveled, and it was so easy getting here, and it's such a blessing and a relief. And I'm so close to my family, my wife, and my friends now. Before I was pretty egotistical. Mm-hmm. And George Steele was an egotistical jerk. Jim Myers wasn't that way, but George was. I talked to a lot of the guys that would come into the WWF as a guy that's there to a carpenter to help build a superstar. Sometimes they call them jobbers now. I never did do that. I've always respected the guys that I worked with. Mm-hmm. They'd come in on TV, and I'd beat them up pretty bad to make me look good. You know, those guys I have a lot of respect for. Again, they would come in and I never really acknowledged them. Or they'd go around, how you doing? I wasn't one of those guys. That started with the Hulk Hogan era, where you're going around and shook everybody's hand, how you doing, brother, as you're looking at somebody else. That was never me. Even as an agent, if a guy had a good match, I didn't tell him that every night because that becomes redundant. I would watch the matches, and I knew it was having a good match. If something needed to be tweaked a little bit, I could do that. But I wasn't running around, you know, with a bouquet of flowers throwing them out, because to me, that was a bunch of nonsense. If somebody had a bad match, they would hear about it from me. And
sure.
Occasionally, when, you know, probably once a week, I'd tell a guy, that was a great match, you're doing a great job. But I didn't do that every night. But I was a little different character, too.
You know, I'm sure in 8 million interviews, you're asked about the Randy Savage, Elizabeth storyline and everything like that, so we don't have to go too much into it, but it is very sad, looking back, obviously, that both Randy Savage and Elizabeth have since passed on, and both of them a lot younger than you, and I mean, obviously, you'll talk a lot about it in the book and your faith and everything, but do you feel that, I guess, actually, what do you feel? Why did you make it and so many others from the 80s did not?
Well, I you know, obviously, the body like I had, I was a big, strong, naturally strong guy. That was one of my gifts from God way back when. So I was never into steroids and bodybuilding or even weightlifting. Rarely did I even go to the gym. And then the media jumps all over things, and they made it play like, the big problem with the WWWF and the WWF and the WWE is steroid use. It's a bunch of nonsense. Our young people, and there's a lot more than Randy and Liz, but a lot of people that died, you know, under the age of 55 and under the age of 50 and some under the age of 30 was not from steroids. It was from pain pills, prescribed pain pills, and alcohol. That's what's killing our people. And now they've cleaned that up pretty much, and most of the young guys understand that now. But the pain pills and the alcohol is what kills our young people. It has killed our young people.
Is it true that you, when you were working as an agent, were also involved in collecting samples for the drug testing?
Oh, yeah.
What year was this?
Oh, golly, Pete. Now, I'm going to be guessing, but I would say that would have been around 1992, 1993. I was real sick at the time, and I would be on the road and then off the road and on the road. I mean, Vince was very good along with me, but yes, we were doing the drug testing big time, and it was a real deal. In fact, I had to testify in front of the federal grand jury when they were trying to indict Vince McMahon and the WWF for different abuses, and some of the people they were interviewing in the federal grand juries would be in there 2 hours, hour and a half. They kept me in there about 20 minutes. First of all, I was funny. I had
sure.
The grand jury laughing. They wanted autographs. and I told the truth. They said, did everybody take the drug test? I said, are you telling me that if I told Andre the Giant to pee in a cup and he said no, that I was going to take his pee-pee and make him pee in the cup? I said, first of all, I didn't figure he was on steroids. He's 6'3". And you know, those kinds of things.
Sure.
The testing was real. The testing was real. And we were one of the first companies for a while that also tested for marijuana.
Yeah.
So we were out there doing, it. There was guys that flunked the test. And the things that I respect about the way that we did it back then, the NFL had guys that were super football players that would fail a drug test for steroids. And they would put it all over the news that they had failed a test for steroids. And they'd sit off two or three games. And then they'd come back and have a all-pro game and look great. When our people had drug problems or steroid problems, we took them off the road, we paid for them to go to rehabilitation, and we never said why they were not there. We didn't promote the use of drugs or steroids to the young kids. I thought the NFL was doing it backwards, and I thought we were doing it right.
Now, during that period, it was, when you talk about the serious drug testing, I mean, if you were a fan at the time, I mean, you saw some noticeable physique changes. In fact, that's the rumor that the Ultimate Warrior had died and there was a new Ultimate Warrior. I mean, that came from the fact that when he came back, his physique was completely different. Do you believe that there were still some guys who, for whatever reason, managed to get around the tests, even though...
No question about it.
Yeah.
They're still doing it today. I mean, you come up with a test, they'll come up with a way to disguise it and come another way. Whoever's developing this stuff can also tell you how to hide it.
Sure.
And that's going on today. I mean, baseball is going through it. Right now, they just got 10 guys got sit down for something new that they weren't even looking for. Somebody else just told them about it. They didn't even know it existed.
But overall, the period when you were doing the testing, I mean, the idea was we're going to catch as many people as we can if they're on something.
That was not our goal. Our goal was to clean up the act.
Sure.
See, we had just, Vince McMahon had just been, I don't know, some of it was before and then some of it was after, But Vince McMahon had a federal grand jury investigation going on with the drug use involving him and the Hulk and some other people. And I had to testify, and I just told you about that earlier on. And it broke my heart to have to sit down and testify about a business that I had learned to love, that I originally hated, but I had learned to love, and was being dragged through the sewer. And the funny thing is, I think they spent $37 million at WWF at that time defending themselves, and they were never brought on trial. What does that tell you? The trial come in, there was no one was ever called as a witness to defend the WWF, and the case was thrown out.
Now, let me ask you this question about the two different eras. And obviously you were there, so you would know better than I, but it seems to me that in the 80s, not just in wrestling, but throughout popular culture, everything was larger than life. You had these big-time stars, the movie stars were gigantic, everything was just big, the hair was big, everything was big. And the impression that I always sort of had was there were a lot of guys in wrestling that were on steroids, and I always felt that if they weren't in wrestling, they probably would still be on steroids just because of the mindset of the 80s, whereas today, if there are guys on steroids in WWE, if they were out of wrestling, I don't think that they would be on steroids. I think there's guys today that maybe they feel, okay, in order to get a big push, I've got to get a certain physique. But if it weren't for that, I wouldn't be doing this stuff. And maybe that's why there's less usage today than there was in the 80s. Do you get that impression, or what was it about the 80s that had everybody on everything?
Oh, here's what happened. Let's just go back and remember. Get a look at a little history now, a little drug history. What were the drugs of choice?
Cocaine.
Heroin, cocaine, marijuana, and all kinds of, entertainment drugs.
Sure.
Steroids were legal. They were not illegal. They were legal. And the Drug Administration was being driven crazy by the cocaines, the other drugs. So all of a sudden, they pass a law against steroids, and they knew how to find these people, go to the gym and just look at them, and you could figure out who they were, and then follow them a little bit, and you could break some drug people. They're having tremendous failures with the recreation drugs, if you remember correctly. So I believe this is political. We can talk about it all day. As a professional athlete, I pretty much think what you put in your body is your own business. I don't think it's the Senate's or the Congress's business of what you're doing in wrestling or baseball or football or basketball. I mean, these are professional athletes. And most of them know how to, whatever substance they're putting in their body for athletic abilities, they know how to do that, how to roll it out, and they don't die from that. They die from pain pills and booze. Mm-hmm. But when I was very sick, very, very sick, I was on a lot of prednisone. In fact, the maximum you're supposed to be on in prednisone is 60 milligrams. I was on 120. Mm. Prednisone is a steroid. Sure, I had huge mood swings, but it's a steroid, and the doctors were prescribing it. If you have an injury, steroids can restore your body quicker than anything else. That's why they were using them before they became illegal. I'm not there on a soapbox saying, okay, legalize steroids. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying let's look at the history and why did they become illegal? What's going on? What's the big deal?
As someone who's worked in athletics for your whole life, really, What are your thoughts on drugs in sports? Because there's the argument that we need to do everything we can to eradicate them. And then there's the argument that, well, you know what? A lot of people are on them, so maybe just don't even test. It'll be a different sort of even playing field, and away we go.
You know what? That's a question that I think each individual athlete should have to answer for themselves. It's not one that I should answer for all the athletes. But I think each one of them is a personal thing and a private thing, and it's their choice to do or not do. Same with alcohol. It's a choice of drinking or not drinking. Would you rather have a test take down an athlete or an injury take down an athlete? Which would you prefer?
Now, when you retired, you obviously got your health issues taken care of. What year was it where you became cured of your Crohn's disease?
Wow, I don't know if you can put a year on it or not, because I didn't know, you know, I don't know that answer. I don't know. When I was finally found out that I was cured was about 2000. But it was like 3 or 4 years in here that I didn't know. I shut down twice on the table from the drugs I was on. Mm-hmm. Pharmaceutical drugs that almost killed me. You know, and I think pharmaceutical drugs are as dangerous as any drugs they have out there, except they can prescribe them. And half the people that take them when they're doing the test survive, as half don't, I guess. Who knows? Those are questions that, again, I think that there's some parties out there that have their nose in a business that they really don't belong in.
So you were in your 50s during...
I'm a liberal person. I'm very, very conservative.
Sure. Now, you retired. You eventually got this taken care of. I know you did a couple of appearances. You late 90s, you did a WWF deal with the Oddities. You had an appearance in WCW. You had an appearance, non-wrestling appearance, in TNA. And was there ever thought of, you know what? I'm going to come back and regularly. I know you've had dates here and there where you've wrestled, but once you retired, was it kind of like, okay, the full-time aspect of this job is behind me. I'm going to do this for fun. I'm going to take care of myself. It's time to move on.
Exactly. That's exactly where I was coming from. The Oddity thing was a tongue-in-cheek with me. When I went to the WCW with that thing with... the guy with the guitar, what was his name?
Jeff Jarrett.
Yeah, Jarrett. And that was just my way of doing closure with Vince McMahon. Because I knew that Vince was real big in closure, and I'd always been very, very loyal to the program. And things weren't coming around the way that I should, so I thought, let's just shut the door on this altogether. That's why I showed up there. And another reason I showed up there is I got my faith in 2002. And I was leading in that direction. And the storylines that the WWF had at the time, fornication in the coffin, gay marriages, and all this nonsense they were doing did not fit where my life was headed. So back then they sent me a contract. I like to remember it as a Legends contract. I don't remember what they called it. They sent me a contract. It was all right, with some pretty good deals in it. But me and my wife talked about it. I said, you know, where they've taken this business doesn't fit my lifestyle now. Storylines is anything I'd want my grandchildren to see. In fact, I turned down some movies because of storylines. Mm-hmm. And it turned me off. I showed up at a show in maybe 2011, 2012. Where they had old timers come in for the Raw show. Mm-hmm. I showed up there because they had cleaned up their act. Because they were getting their sponsorship back. It was about money, always. And then I started writing this book. This is how the Lord has worked in my life. I turned down that around 2001, 2002, whenever it was, the Legends contract. And then I'm writing a book. So in 2000, I think it's 12 or 13, 12, the Triumph Books asked me to contact the WWF and see if they could use some of their pictures. So I contact the WWF. I'm led to a guy by the name of Archer, and Michael Archer, and because he's in charge of the film type thing. Mm-hmm. I'm talking to him. He said, oh, yes, sure, George. You can have anything you want. We'll do everything we can do to help you. You're one of our Hall of Famers. And then he said, you were sent a contract a few years back. And then I remember the contract, and I said, said, yes. He said, you never sent it back. And you sent another one, you didn't send it back. He sent another one, you never sent it back. I said, yes. He said, why? And I told him why, like I just told you. The storylines did not fit my faith. And he laughed. He said, well, I agree with you 100%. We were way overboard. He said, if I were to send you that contract now, because I'm the one that was sending them, would you sign it now? I said, absolutely. So the door that I closed when I first accepted my faith, the Lord opened when I was writing my book. Does that make sense? You see what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
That's how things have worked. So now I'm under contract with the WWF as a legend. And I laugh because a lot of your shows like yours. I'm going to ask you a question. What's a wrestling legend?
What is a wrestling legend?
Yeah.
Wrestling legend is one of the famous names in the history of this business.
How far down deep do you dig to be a legend? What I'm trying to get at is it seems to me like every old wrestler is a legend.
That's kind of how it is with the Hall of Fame.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
I'm not knocking, I'm just saying, you know, and they say, okay, you're a legend. I don't know what that means. I know that.
A recognizable name from the history of this business. How about that?
You know, wrestling is like a hot dog. Some people like it with ketchup and mustard. Some like it plain. Some want beans and chili on it. Wrestling is a very strange business. I love it. I'm not knocking it. But it's to whatever the fan wants it to be. That's what it is.
I ask one last question before we get into these plugs here. You mentioned that you love it. You when you began, had not watched, you were not a wrestling fan, and you fell into this business, and you went to train, and you worked when you weren't teaching and coaching. Do you remember, it's probably not a date, obviously, but maybe a time in your life where you suddenly realized, I love this pro wrestling?
It was funny. When I first started, I'd struggle through a match, and all of a sudden, maybe a month later, I started having a pretty decent match. I thought, boy, I'm catching on. And then I'd go out and I would be totally blank and struggle again. When it finally hit me, it was like that. And a guy like that, you guys don't even know him, but he's probably one of the greatest workers in the history of our business, Leapin' Larry Shane. When he jumped on my bandwagon because somebody else was trying to shortcut me and took me under his wing and started explaining a lot of this stuff to me, I started picking up on it and I started to really get it. And then the other thing I was blessed with, there was two of us that really kind of started in the business together, Gary Hart and myself. Gary Hart is one of the real true geniuses of our business. Way back when, we learned this together and we both had a totally different outlook on the wrestling business than most of the guys did back then. And our idea was, let's think like this is real. Not act, let's think like it's real. And so therefore, I worked very, very stiff because I was working like it was real. And Bruno Sammartino was on the same page. He was very, very stiff. What we did was pretty much real. Although we knew the outcome, it was real tough stuff. And I think that part of it, it really is what I bought into and I enjoyed. Later on, when I became the lovable cartoon character of George Steele, that was just a big ha-ha in my mind. I made more money than you can imagine at that point in my career. But when that started, I was like 47, 48, 49. I was over the hill, and I had a great run with that. In fact, the run with Randy and Elizabeth just was great retirement money. It was just the timing was perfect. Again, what was an old guy like I doing in the 80s when the business was at its very top, being one of the very top main eventers with a superstar like Randy Savage? How did that work? And being meant to sit, you know, start. They didn't plan on this thing lasting 2 years. It was just kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing, Beauty and the Beast, and it took off. It was one of the, they had, at that time he was running 3 shows a night. Hulk Hogan and whoever would be in one town. Randy Savage and George Steele would be in another town. And Honky Tonk or whoever would be in another town. And we were all doing great business.
Now, at the end of the day, it was a simple, like you said, Beauty and the Beast. Yep. It was a simple storyline, and Elizabeth was the perfect beauty. You were the perfect beast, and Randy Savage was pretty awesome. So, in the end, I mean, it probably sounded going in like this shouldn't last a while, but when you look at the dynamic of all three characters, I mean, it really shouldn't be much of a surprise. Everything worked perfectly.
Exactly.
The book, Animal, by George the Animal Steel, is available, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. Your website, obviously, is georgetheanimalsteel.com. And I want to give you an opportunity here to plug the book, the website, and anything else you'd like to get out there.
Well, you know, I'm not really one to be plugging. I just hope that people do read the book, and I hope that they let me know what they think about it, and I hope it touches their life in one way or another. I've talked to a lot of people. It's a very readable book, very easy to read. There's a lot of humor in it. I mean, with all the sad stories, there's a ton of humor. My life has been full of humor. And enjoy my website. I love to communicate with people. I'm really cutting down on my travels because my age is getting a little difficult. And I just really, truly, truly love the fans of professional wrestling. I think they're the most loyal people in the world. In a lot of cases, they've really been mistreated by some of the superstars and promoters. And this is just my way of giving back. So thank you for the opportunity, and God bless.
I want to thank you so much for doing the show. GeorgeTheAnimalSteel.com, everybody. And there's links to Twitter, Facebook. Obviously, the book is available on Amazon.com. And I want to wish you the very best. Thanks so much for doing the show today. It was an awesome time. And, of course, thanks, everybody, for listening. We shall talk to you again after a while.